they get better informed? How can they plug in?
Yeah, definitely. Check out our website, OregonFairTrade.org. We're also on Twitter at ORFTC, and we have a Facebook page too.
We've been talking with Robin Gottlieb of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, and first you heard from Danielle Rueda, a organizer in Columbia of Coca-Cola workers. Listeners here in Portland who've been active in the fight for trade justice will understand why. I will end this show by honoring the spirit of one of our most dedicated activists, someone who's very much alive in this struggle today. Greg Margolis, presente. Thank you and good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 15th Annual Village Building Convergence, May 29th to June 7th, all over Portland. Each day of the convergence, at over 40 sites all around the city, people will create community spaces that feature public art, gathering places, permaculture gardens, and natural buildings. In the evening, there will be speakers, community gathering, and music. The 6 evenings of events are all held at St. David's Community Center at 2800 Southeast Harrison Street in Portland. Again, that's the Village Building Convergence, happening May 29th through June 7th, all over Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be.
Good evening. Greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. This evening, we are here with activist scholar Dan Berger. Hey, Dan, how you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thanks for taking time, on the holiday here. It's Memorial Day, if folks didn't already know. And kind of in that context, Dan, you have written some great work. You've been really prolific the last couple of years, talking about different aspects of American justice movements, from really underground revolutionary work to above ground prison abolition, political prisoner support kind of organizing. And so, of course, a couple questions about that. How did you get involved with all this work? How is it relevant today? And kind of last part, since it is Memorial Day, how does some of that fit into kind of a different maybe narrative when we talk about memorial and veterans and war?
Yeah, well, there's a lot there. I mean, I'll say I got involved in all these issues as a teenager, as mm-hmm. a young activist, and looking for some sense of other examples from history of things that worked and things that didn't work, and having a really hard time finding sort of older comrades and movement elders and people who to sort of talk history with, and to talk movement history with. This was in the mid 1990s, or early to mid 1990s, mm-hmm. and ultimately came across groups that were doing support work for for political prisoners, and started writing people, and so veterans of the Black Panther Party and the Weather Underground and other radical anti-racist, anti-imperialist political prisoners who had been serving, you know, longer time in prison than I had been alive, and it struck me as sort of ultimately as not more than just a coincidence that the best place for a suburban teenager to learn kind of the true history of some of these struggles was through prison, because mm-hmm. so right. much of what prisons do is and the rise of mass incarceration is really stemmed from this attempt to erase those movements. And so I think when we think about it in the context of Memorial Day, I think part of the work of prison abolition and political prisoner support, and even just the work of those of us who want to stop mass incarceration on a broader scale, is about remembering the campaigns and movements and struggles that have come before us, and the various ways in which state violence tries to erase them off the face of existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you were in upstate New York, right?
I grew up in upstate New York, and then we moved to Florida, and so it was actually that move to Florida when I was sort of separated from a kind of political community that I was getting politicized with, that ultimately led me to start corresponding with different political prisoners.
Sure, right, yeah, because you were close in upstate New York to, you know, Attica, right, and Comstock and Auburn, all these places where some of the longest held U.S. political prisoners are. Can you talk a little bit about that and those folks?
Yeah, so I mean, I grew up kind of central upstate New York, in about a half hour from Auburn, which is the oldest continually functioning prison in U.S. history.
Right.
And you know, I moved when I was 14. I didn't have any idea at the time, but actually, you know, the prisons throughout New York are kind of, you know, scattered throughout that central and upstate part of the state.
Right.
And there are people like Herman Bell, Jaleel Muntakim, David Gilbert, Robert Seth Hayes, Abdul Majid, and until recently Sekou Odinga, who had been kind of shuffled between these medieval, archaic prisons in Attica, Auburn, Comstock, and Dannemora. And these are, you know, these are sort of prisons straight out of central casting, the sort of foreboding high walls and surrounded with all kinds of high-tech machinery. And they, you know, the men who I just listed, with the exception of David Gilbert, are all former members of the Black Panther Party. And they've been serving decades in prison. And New York is really interesting. In the past few years, you know, as the whole country has witnessed this, you know, reform spirit, right, and sort of come to the realization that it costs far too much money to incarcerate so many people, New York has actually been, you know, somewhat progressive in closing a few prisons and in trying to make some modest headway towards reducing the sentencing disparity through the various kind of war on drugs policies. But of course, there's been no movement around at the official level around freeing political prisoners, around reducing some of the things that actually cause, you know, mass incarceration in New York State, which includes these, you know, maximum security facilities where, you know, violence against prisoners is such a common occurrence, and where several of these political prisoners who I mentioned have been serving, you know, 30 or 40 years.
Well, yeah, you mentioned Auburn, New York. Another thing that's interesting about Auburn, people probably don't really realize this, actually, unless they have a really cursory history of Harriet Tubman, which is that she actually settled in the very, you know, last years of her life in Auburn, New York. So it's like right down the street from the prison, you know. So it kind of brings another question, actually, in a sense. You know, again, it's Memorial Day. We're talking about this cultural memory, this legacy of resistance, really from, you know, the early days of, you know, slavery and genocide in the Americas, you know, up until, well, at least as far as the era that these political prisoners come out of, you know, the civil rights era, essentially, Black liberation struggles, Puerto Rican independence, or what have you. So as far as the work that you've been doing, you know, the research and writing with these folks, can you talk about the books that you've been, that you recently put out, and kind of what comes out of that research exactly? What does that kind of tell us about this legacy of resistance? And also kind of, I mean, obviously you're really undigging some stuff that, you know, people don't want to talk about, you know, and it's the kind of more, you know, the establishment ideas of the civil rights movement and stuff kind of challenging that narrative. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, for sure. So I published two two books last year. One is a short book called The Struggle Within, Prisons, Political Prisoners, and Mass Movements in the United States.
Excellent.
And that is a short, like 100-page primer on the history of U.S. political prisoners, you know, during and since the 60s, right? So the different movements that they come from, right? How so many people found themselves incarcerated and incarcerated for such long periods of time. And then my thoughts, right, on what it means to sort of free them as part of a larger anti-prison movement. And that book has a foreword by the scholar activist Ruth Wilson Gilmore and journalist and activist Dream Hampton. And then I also published a book called Captive Nation, Black Prison Organizing in the Civil Rights Era. And that one is, you know, like 400 pages and is a different, much heftier book than The Struggle Within, and a much more focused look at the time period from the 1950s to the 1980s to try and examine the ways that black people in and out of prison sort of turned turn the sort of mechanisms of state violence into a source of a freedom struggle. And I was especially interested in the ways that people in prison constituted such a vital part of the civil rights and black power movements, almost in ways that we overlook, right? You know, in January we have Martin Luther King Day, in February we have Black History Month, and on both of those occasions we have a lot of, you know, images of civil rights demonstrators, you know, standing up to overtly racist Southern sheriffs and getting arrested for it, right? Getting beaten and brutalized and arrested for it. So much so that we almost take for granted, right? The fact that actually these activists and, you know, countless others all throughout the country stood up to the most extreme forms of state violence and said, we are not afraid. And in fact, used their experience in prisons at the hands of police as a base of strength and support for really what was a global movement. And so I wanted to uncover that history, as you said. I wanted to recognize it. I wanted to analyze it, you know, critically in some ways, and just to really, you know, I was working on that project for close to 10 years. And so when I started on it, you know, I was one of, you know, several people who were doing that intellectual work as part, and also with a connection to social movements, but the wider world wasn't really talking about the kind of prison regime and the kind of state violence in the U.S. And so I felt like, for me, I was starting off, you know, with this idea of trying to convince the wider world, well, you know, or at least the wider American public, that, you know, you can't keep killing and caging people and not expect resistance to happen,
right?
Because here was this, you know, in the at the height of Jim Crow white supremacy in the U.S., you know, was the exact moment when people were turning prisons into what they said, right? Turning prisons into schools of liberation, right? From, you know, I think it was Dr. King who said, you know, from dungeons of shame into temples of liberty, and so on and so on. And so I set out with this book to be like, well, look, here is this history of people actually transforming the mechanisms of state violence into a catalyst for liberation. And of course, by the time the book came out, we had the tremendous and exciting upsurge of the Black Lives Matter movement. And so in a lot of ways, I view both of those books, right, as a kind of prehistory to our current struggles, where so many people are so creatively and urgently challenging state violence in our own context. And for me, I think the important piece of that is to really remember those connections to folks that are incarcerated, and to really remember that they are also key members and participants and even leaders in these movements.
Right, and there's really good opportunities for that right now, like you mentioned, with the emergence of Black Lives Matter. We're also on the eve of the 50th anniversary of the Black Panther Party. And so with all that and all these things that you've discovered from your work, your activist work on the ground, your this intellectual academic work that you're doing, I mean, you're also teaching as well, students. So what is your, in a sense, kind of maybe, for lack of better words, I'm going to say kind of appraisal of where this activism is at now and how it's transformed from the historical periods that you've been looking at? What are the threads, but then what's different and maybe more effective or less effective now?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and there's a lot to that. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I definitely encourage people to to check out the books.
For, you have 30
for,
seconds
for the
answer.
Fuller answer. But I think my short answer to it is, you know, I mean, I read a lot in Captive Nation about, you know, the full range of riots and strikes and clandestine newspapers, mm-hmm. You know, physical confrontations that happened inside of American prisons in especially the late 60s through the mid 70s. And at that time period, there are, you know, a couple hundred thousand people in prison in the U.S. And now, of course, as I'm sure your listeners know, we have more than 2.3 million mm-hmm. people in prisons and jails, and even more when you include other sites of detention like immigrant detention facilities and
right.
so on. And so to think, you know, about the full range of, you know, the dramatic expansion of solitary confinement, the death penalty, various other forms of isolation, right? The state really learned a lot of lessons from the organizing that was happening in that time period, right? They figured out how to separate people within prison as well as how to further separate people in prison from people on the outside. So, you know, on the left, people, there's a slogan, right, about resistance, repression breeds resistance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in some sense, that's true, but I don't think we can afford to so casually or cavalierly rely on that,
mm-hmm.
Because I think the history of the last, you know, 40 years shows that repression also can work,
mm-hmm.
that the state has a dramatic, you know, monopoly on force and has proved itself infinitely able and willing to use it in its own interest, as it did in the 60s and 70s against the rise of Black liberation and other kind of freedom struggles of that era.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one thing, right, is to really recognize that repression can work and that we can't afford to be nonchalant or cavalier about it.
Mm-hmm.
And in some sense, I think that's something that is really exciting and impressive about this current moment. When I first heard that slogan of Black Lives Matter after the murder of Trayvon Martin, I was, obviously heartbroken and sad at just world events. And Black Lives Matter has been this kind of, you know, it seemed to me an absolutely necessary slogan and
mm-hmm.
and just so depressing that that was even the necessary slogan.
Mm-hmm.
To move from an era of talking about, you know, Black liberation and Black freedom to saying sort of Black Lives Matter at that most basic level. And yet I think because we are at that most basic level, right, because the extent of white supremacy in the U.S. is so strong, I actually think, you know, we're poised to make more transformative mobilizations
mm-hmm.
Now than before. The other thing I'll say is, you know, I read a lot about George Jackson and the people kind of around him that he worked with, that he was inspired by, as well as those he inspired that came after him.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, you know, and there was a lot of physical and violent confrontations, right? This was a a time period in which the California prison guards had killed a number of prisoners without any repercussions. And George Jackson was one of many prisoners who said, who believed that that there needed to be a certain kind of, I don't know, eye for an eye, I guess would be the easiest way of putting it. Right? They felt that if, as long as prison guards were killing prisoners and feeling like they could do so with impunity and without any repercussions, that would continue to happen. And so many people said, well, we need to, like, defend ourselves. We need to fight back in some way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that I think, became a core part of the prison movement, certainly in California in those years. And, you know, and it had all kinds of results that people will have to read the book to find out. But but to me, it seemed, you know, there's certainly various kinds of gruesome incidents that one could describe. And to me, it seemed like a kind of tragic necessity, you know, that prisons are so tucked away, right? And it is the place where state violence is allowed to be at sort of most naked and most extreme, because no one can see it, right? Mm-hmm. Only the people who experience it. And it was hard for me to imagine how else, right, people could challenge it and change it in some way. And then the California prisoners went on hunger strike, starting in 2011, and went on a series of three hunger strikes over 3 years, as I'm sure people know. And at its height, they had 30,000 people refusing food in protest of long-term solitary confinement and the various violences and violations that go along with it. And that, to me, was a tremendously inspiring. And I think that level of organization and creativity, right, from people who are not allowed to encounter another human being face-to-face for decades on end, and yet able to mobilize not only within the prison without seeing each other, but across prisons, across one of the biggest states in the country, to me it was phenomenal. And really shows something about the a sort of testament to the spirit of human resilience, creativity, and resistance. And so I am just, you know, I think the obstacles to confront and overcome are in many ways so much more severe and extreme than they were 40 years ago. And I think some of the creative forms of mobilization that have happened both in prison and out of prison in the Black Lives Matter movement have been tremendously inspiring.
For folks just tuning in, you are listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. And we're here with Dan Berger, activist scholar. Dan, you know, you just mentioned some key words here, creative forms of mobilization. And we've also talked a little bit about repression. And just kind of to segue real quick here, because we are going to be showing, and for our listeners, please come by Clinton Street Theater next Monday evening, around this time, actually, from 7 to 9. And it's a KBOO-sponsored event. We'll be showing a film called COINTELPRO 101. So that's at Clinton Street Theater, which is next Monday, June 1st, from 7 to 9 p.m. And it's KBOO-sponsored. It's a film documentary made by Freedom Archives about political repression. It's about an FBI illegal program from the late 60s, the counterintelligence program under J. Edgar Hoover. And people are probably maybe familiar with this. Or if you want to learn more, definitely come see the film. We'll have a great discussion, too. So Dan, kind of in that same vein, how are you seeing these creative forms of mobilization responding to this historical and also contemporary repression? Because like you said, it's gotten really, it's worse. It's been augmented by technology. The system has gotten probably even more, you know, dangerous and violent, the way it treats activists and prisoners and what have you. And so can you talk more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think part of the problem for the FBI with COINTELPRO is that so much of what they did was illegal. Mm-hmm. And so after COINTELPRO was exposed in 1974, and there were lots of hearings and a big controversy, and it, you know, certainly wrapped up with everything that was happening with Watergate and so on. But you know, in the 80s onward, the FBI and other actors in the state really tried to make legal so much of the things that they did. So part of what's worse now is that, you know, the Patriot Act and NSA and so on, right? The scope of surveillance, you know, alone, much less the scope of prisons and the scope of policing, have been so much more extreme,
mm-hmm.
right? And since it is the month of May, also worth acknowledging, we just passed the 30th anniversary of when Philadelphia police dropped a bomb on the Move House, mm-hmm. in West Philadelphia in 1985, right. May 13th, 1985, and killed 11 people inside the house and then let the fire destroy a whole city block. And I think, you know, that wasn't COINTELPRO, right? That was the Philadelphia police.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that testifies, right, to the forms of policing that we've been living with ever since, right? No one was ever, you know, brought to trial or faced any kind of repercussions, mm-hmm. for bombing a house, for
right.
the state
terrorism
bomb on a house in a densely populated black neighborhood of Philadelphia, right? And so when we look at all of these contemporary examples of extrajudicial, you know, police killings, right? Because of the protests, because of the response, you know, some officers in some places have been have faced charges, but you know, even more of them haven't.
Right, right.
And so I think the fact that, you know, the repression that we're dealing with, and I think this is something that prisoners in the 60s and 70s spoke quite eloquently about, right? The repression that is most strongly concentrated against black communities and Native communities and Puerto Rican communities, right? The repression that is experienced most harshly by the most marginalized also becomes generalized to the rest of society.
Mm-hmm.
So that we all live with the fact, right? Even though, you know, as a, you know, white person, you know, from middle class background, raised in the suburbs, like, I'm very unlikely to be gunned down in the street, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I still live in a society where that happens, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And knowing how prominent that is, right? How frequent that is, you know, is a tremendous devastation to whole communities in a very immediate, very personal sense, right? But it also has a kind of chilling effect against political mobilization in general. And so I think the Black Lives Matter movement has been so necessary, so important, and so inspiring to kind of reimagine a collective politics, right?
Mm-hmm.
To imagine a, like, collective, radical, internationalist, multiracial grouping united around this idea of Black Lives Matter, right? And being willing and to bring that everywhere, right? So part of what I think is so creative and amazing about this moment, right, is the ability of people to, you know, craft and stage protests, actions, conversations, you know, everywhere from the St. Louis Opera, right, to the beach, to the solitary confinement cells of Pelican Bay Prison, to the streets of Baltimore and Philadelphia and Seattle and Portland and so many other places. And I think expanding that sense of collectivity, right, and fighting against the harshest forms of state violence will, I hope, reinvigorate our sort of political and human possibilities.
Right. Well, Dan, we're just in our last minute or two here. Can you just briefly, you know, just mention, you know, again, information about your recent works, and also if you want to, you know, give a quick shout out to any organizations or websites people should be checking out to find out more about all of this kind of work.
Yeah, for sure. So the two books that I just wrote. One is called The Struggle Within, mm-hmm. Prisons, Political Prisoners, and Mass Movements in the United States, which was published by PM Press.
Mm-hmm.
And the other book is called Captive Nation, Black Prison Organizing in the Civil Rights Era, published by the University of North Carolina Press. And I definitely recommend folks check out thejerichomovement.com for more information about political prisoners mm-hmm. in the U.S. And check out organizations like Decarcerate PA in mm-hmm. Pennsylvania, decarceratepa.info, and criticalresistance.org, which is a national prison abolition organization.
Great, great. Yeah, we got a critical resistance chapter here also in Portland. And you also mentioned PM Press, which is also co-sponsoring the event that we'll be having again next Monday, June 1st. Monday, June 1st from 7 to 9 p.m. at Clinton Street Theater. We'll be showing COINTELPRO 101, and there'll also be a nice discussion after that about organizing and all the kind of stuff we were just discussing. So, Dan, want to thank you so much for being on. I know we're just kind of scratching the surface on all these issues, so we'll have to have you back on again soon, okay?
Thanks. It would be my pleasure.
Right on. So listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. And I want to thank our awesome engineers. We want to thank Dan Berger for being on tonight. Have a great evening. Free them all, and we'll see you next week.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Student Debtors Assembly, Thursday, May 28th, 2 p.m. in the Park Block at Southwest Harrison in Portland. A debtors assembly is a public forum to talk about debt, to dispel stigmas, myths, and taboos about debt, to learn about debt, and to organize to change the state of debt in our lives. There will be presentations from organizers, academics,